is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. On today's show, we will hear from a candidate for Secretary of State and State Superintendent of Public Instruction within the hour. But we begin the program by talking to Governor Matt Mead, who's seeking his second term in office. In his first 2 years, the state faced budget cuts and worked with lawmakers to reduce government. Now the revenue picture has improved. Unemployment has dropped, exports have increased, but the state is still facing some challenges, most notably when it comes to the future of coal. He also has had some controversies, from signing legislation that took away powers from Superintendent Cindy Hill to allowing a budget amendment that banned the adoption of some science standards to not expanding Medicaid. The governor is facing Cheyenne businessman and Dr. Taylor Haynes and the previously mentioned Superintendent Hill in the Republican primary. We begin our conversation by discussing some of the challenges facing the state.
Certainly one of the reasons we are as strong as we are is we have a great private sector out there, and minerals is a big part of that. And when we see the challenges, particularly on coal right now, it's certainly a cause of concern. And so been very aggressive. As you know, I think we've got now 13 or 14 lawsuits against the EPA. And it's not the best way, you know, it's not how you like to go because, you know, having lawsuits sort of prevents something bad happening, but it's not a proactive way in how you want to go in the future. So we're working on that as well in terms of innovation and technology, what we're doing at University of Wyoming and what we hope to do with the integrated test center with coal.
Along those same lines, though, there are people that believe this would be a perfect opportunity to really ramp up what we're doing with alternative energy, wind, solar, that type of thing. What about that argument?
Well, I think that the as you see globally, we have an expanding middle class, you know, tens of millions per year globally. And I think it's very premature to take any fuel source off the table, and I think it's time to add to them. And I think renewables certainly are part of that. As you know, we're getting ready, hopefully, to put up one of the largest, if not the world largest, wind farm in the world here in Wyoming. And we have the best onshore class 5, 6, 7 wind. And that's certainly part of it. But for people that think renewables is an easy answer, you should visit people who've been working through permitting on wind farms. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is not easy. I mean, it takes many years. It's very expensive. And then on top of the issue of the wind farm itself, you have the transmission issue. And putting transmission lines across a county, let alone a state, let alone multiple states, is a huge challenge. It involves so much in terms of environmental analysis, in terms of politics, and rather I want it on somebody else's county, not my county. But I do believe the traditional energy sources, we have to keep those strong, and I think we have to add to it because affordable energy is one of the great things worldwide, and particularly in Wyoming and the U.S. When you have affordable energy, we see the economy going up because it's tied not – you know, people think of about it, Bob, in terms of my electricity costs or my heating costs, but it's food costs, transportation costs, housing costs. It's tied to everything that we do. And so I'm not interested in taking away from the energy portfolio. I am interested in adding to it, including renewables.
One of the things about coal that's sort of interesting is you're starting to see maybe some other countries get in on some of this discussion. Is the realistic approach that you'll have to take as you look forward is that we're probably going to have a lot less revenue from that, no matter what we try to do legally and whatever?
I'm not willing to concede that. I think as I, you know, if I travel to Taiwan and South Korea, I see what China's doing. Coal is the fastest growing energy source right now. And when you can produce it as we can in Wyoming in not only environmentally sound way, but in terms of worker safety with world-class reclamation, low sulfur, high BTU coal, I think that the market is going to help us eventually continue to have strong coal. But having said that, I'm not unrealistic in terms of the challenges that we have. One is even outside of EPA, trying to get it out of the ports on the West Coast. As you know, I've been out there and working on that issue. That's a challenge. And then the EPA rules in and of themselves certainly are a challenge because in my view, what the EPA rules do is they certainly in and of themselves put a tremendous pressure on the coal industry. But beyond that, they put a stigma on it so that, you know, as I've said in speeches, you know, I'm not a scientist, but my dad taught me you don't vaccinate a dead cow. In other words, you know, why put a lot of money, innovation, and effort into something that looks like it's not going to be around? And it's unfortunate because what I would prefer, rather than the money we spent in 2013 on just renewable research as a country, which was, you know, 200 and some plus of what we spent over carbon research, that is a, you know, we need to equalize that and have more money into carbon research. And I think the state of Wyoming's leading the way in setting an example with the Integrated Test Center and, you know, 50 plus million here at the university trying to find those solutions. And if we invested more in that, I'm confident that we can find some of these solutions.
Last maybe topic on energy, when we look at oil right now and more gas development certainly taking place, but that seems to be the interesting thing is we're going to be having some oil and gas development, unlike the past, in areas where there's some more heavily populated areas, Cheyenne, Laramie County, you know, certainly some places that we've not seen it before. What are some of the challenges you're trying to get out in front of as you look at some of that? Because if they complained in Pinedale at times, I think the conversation might be ramped up over here.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, in the energy companies, they oil and gas companies, they understand this. And, you know, just as an example, you know, about a year and a half ago, or maybe it was 2 years ago, I said, we need to, as part of my energy strategy, have a baseline water testing. Because overall, we don't want to see another pavilion where something happens and fingers are pointed all the way. So let's start knowing what's there. At the same time, with the Oil and Gas Commission, we're looking at such things as setbacks because, as you're right, as you work in a more populated area, what's the appropriate setback and what are the rules going to be for that? The other issue, obviously, would be flaring. You know, in a populated area or more populated area, when you're flaring, you know, what are the rules on that? So Oil and Gas Commission, we're going to take on setbacks and we're going to take on flaring because our hope is that on this side of the state where it perhaps is more populated that we are able to have that robust oil and gas development. But you have to recognize the area you're in and you have to do it in a way that's responsible that, you know, doesn't cause, you know, the people that come out of the woodwork and say, you know, we're just not going to have this. And so those are things that I think are practical issues that it's the responsibility of the Oil and Gas Commission and the industry and interested people to find real solutions for.
Changing gears, Governor, I very rarely, it goes a couple of weeks where I don't hear somebody talk about Medicaid expansion in some way and our lack of expanding Medicaid. Shouldn't we be doing something about this?
Last session, as you saw, the legislature said, you know, go forward and see what the deal is. And so we're making a good faith effort on that. And in fact, next week, we've got meetings with CMS and HHS. And, you know, what I want to do is say to them, here's Wyoming. Here's the unique things we think about Wyoming, the challenges we have in health care. We have 17,000, 18,000 people that are falling in the gap. Here's what we are going to propose to you as a best deal and along with the legislature and see whether or not we can get HHS, CMS to go forward with it. You see, in Indiana, Governor Pence has proposed some unique things. In Utah, they're proposing some unique things. And so I think it's incumbent upon me and the legislature to say, listen, we may not like it, and in fact, we don't, but we also recognize that as we do this, we have uncompensated care for hospitals, about $200 million a year, that the federal money that we're rejecting now is going to California or Colorado or some other state. And so let's make a pitch and see whether or not HHS, CMS accept it or not, because, you know, it's I don't think we can just sit here and do nothing. And healthcare, I know firsthand, is not just an issue for the individual. It's an issue for the state in terms of economic development and just the healthy nature of the state. It makes a difference. So there is big challenges. I don't like it. As you know, we challenged it in court. But I think it's we got to see what is the best deal we can make now. And it may not be something we'll accept, but we'll see what that is.
It does sound to me like, though, you are trying to work something out.
Well, I think it's you know, that was sort of the people were concerned in the last session. Well, you're not going to make a good try on this. And I think in all these things, you got to see what the best deal is, and we can accept it or reject it. But you know, I think we have to make an attempt.
Did the science standards blow up surprise you?
It did a little bit. I think some of the science, the new generation science standards, was in part tied inappropriately to Common Core, and people are concerned about Common Core and the federal intrusion. But it wasn't a great discussion in terms of, listen, we have to look at these science standards every 5 years, I think it is anyway, and it's something the state has done for many years. And as the group got together and started preparing the next generation science standards, they said, hey, we've already got these look pretty good. Having said that, you know, it's also appropriate where we are now. I think the Board of Education, parents, teachers, superintendents can take a look at it. We know that of the states, I think only 9 states have accepted new generation science standards. I don't know that many have outright rejected them. But whether it's Common Core or whether it's new generation science standards, our state needs to have very high, robust standards.
There's higher standards than those.
There is higher standards. And you see, you know, some states that have rejected or not accepting them have said, hey, those aren't even good enough. We're gonna have higher standards. And I think that would certainly be appropriate for us to look at.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this issue gets resolved sometime soon?
Well, I don't know about soon, but it's got to be resolved. And it's, I think it's something that we'll just have to work through. And hopefully after the election, with the new superintendent, the legislature, the governor's office, we've got to move forward on it. We can't just keep kicking that can down the road.
One last thing for you. Boy, I look at the economic picture in the state. As you pointed out earlier, things look great. Looks like the legislature's getting closer to what they want as an extra reserve account. Where do we go from here? I mean, what's the plan for now, having enough money and setting the budget at an appropriate level?
We are very strong economically. And as I go around and talk to counties and to mayors, they just talk about this rainy day fund and they ask, hey, Gov, do you actually know what rain is? Because the fact is we have to invest in the market, and it's served us very well, but we also have to invest in Wyoming. As I've said, if Wyoming is a stock, I'm betting on Wyoming. And when you go to a town and they have a 50- or 60-year-old water system and you're talking about economic development, you're kidding yourself. You have to have water, sewer, roads, bridges. And so I will continue to be very interested in trying to find a little better mix, in my judgment, on building our infrastructure in the state at the local level and statewide.
Governor Matt Mead, he is one of the candidates seeking the Republican nomination right now for governor. Nice to have you back on the program. Thank you.
Always great to be on. Thank you.
Governor Mead's website is meadforgovernor.com. When we come back, we'll hear 2 stories connected to the shortage of construction workers. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Last week, we told you about how the cost of building a new high school in Rawlins is running millions of dollars more than was expected. Costs are up because construction companies cannot find enough workers in Wyoming, and it is not easy to bring them in from out of state. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan explains.
Jeremy Smith is the business manager for Sheridan School District 1 in Ranchester. He's excited to show me the new Tongue River Elementary School, or at least the plot of land where the school should be.
Well, right now what you're going to see when we get up here a little bit closer is you're going to just see pasture.
The school was supposed to be under construction by now, but last month State School Construction said they didn't have the money.
I think we did everything right in this case. We didn't redesign a whole new school. We went and found one that was built twice already in the state.
The district planned to keep its costs down by borrowing the design for its new school from one that had been built last year in Buffalo. That school
was built for about $211 a square foot. When we opened bids on the same school, it was $280.
In other words, the new Tongue River would cost 25% more than the same school design did last year, just 30 miles away. It's a problem of supply and demand. This year, there's about as much construction work in Wyoming as there was in 2008. But back then, the state had about 30,000 people working in construction. Now, there are only about 22,000.
Usually there's people waiting and willing to come to work. I've been with the business since 99, and it's the worst I've seen.
Ron Kaiser is the vice president of Mike's Electric, one of the contractors that bid high on the new Tongue River School. He's so busy, I had to catch up with him at a job site, a Veterans Association treatment plant just outside of Sheridan. He says he's had to raise benefits to attract enough workers.
What's really strange, you go into an interview and they're actually interviewing you instead of you interviewing them. You know, you're telling them what you have to offer to see if they'll come to work for you.
Mike Sullivan's also scouting the VA job. He works for the general contractor Baytance Enterprises. Sullivan says if you're drug-free and can pass a background check, there's a 50-hour-a-week construction job waiting for you. But for now, if you want to get something built, he can only offer this advice.
Wait. Your turn will come. Yeah, because every project's suffering right now. Every project's suffering.
We don't really have any place to pinpoint that we can draw employees from right now.
That's Wyoming Construction Coalition President Josh Carnahan. Construction work dried up by 2010, and a lot of workers left the state. Carnahan says that now, with the nation's economy much better, it's tough to get those workers to move back.
The only way we can draw employees right now is pay better wages, pay better benefits. That translates it directly into higher bidding costs of projects.
Carnahan says the long-term solution is getting more Wyoming kids into apprenticeships, although that will take time. But that's not the only problem. Public projects in the state, like schools, are subject to what's called in-state preference. Contractors that are based in Wyoming are favored over out-of-state contractors, even if their bid is up to 5% higher. Jim Chappett works for Wyoming's Construction Management Division.
They also have to meet the 70-30 rule. At least 70% of their subcontractors have to be resident contractors.
That means that contractors like Ron Kaiser and Mike Sullivan need to look for employees here in Wyoming to maintain a competitive edge in bidding on public projects. And out-of-state contractors?
They're not coming in and bidding work because they're already 5% behind before they start.
So why not just get rid of in-state preference or suspend it until the current construction boom is over? The policy is set by the legislature, so I called Senate floor leader Phil Nicholas, who has worked on in-state preference for years.
It's a pendulum that moves back and forth, protectionism versus opening it up to or to eliminating any preferences.
Nicholas says he understands why in-state preference is frustrating to some right now. Public projects are a big portion of the current construction boom. But he says if there are no Wyoming contractors available to work on the Tongue River School,
you may have to wait a year. But are you better off to wait a year and keep those people employed, or are you better off to say, well, we're going to go find somebody out of state, bring them in, they're going to bring in their temporary labor, and then they'll be gone?
You can see right here, there's a corner post.
Back in Ranchester, here, Jeremy Smith looks over the fields where he hopes his school will be. He's not mad.
Just frustrated, I think. We got a ton of kids in a really small school, and we're kind of stuck right now.
Smith says the plan now is to go over the school design and try and whittle away any cost they can. They'll open Tongue River Elementary up to bids again in the fall. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Miles Bryan.
As you just heard, a number of employers are having trouble finding enough workers. An influx of Latino workers are moving to Wyoming to take up the slack. But national figures show that Hispanics lead the nation in fatal injuries. And with Wyoming having one of the worst records for workplace fatalities, the question is, are Latinos putting themselves in the line of fire? Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
On a quiet side street in Laramie, a crew of workmen are finishing up a new sidewalk. They've spent all morning cutting cement and are now spraying it down with a hose and scraping out the seams. Cement dust makes white stripes on the street where they've washed it away. The men aren't wearing face masks, even though silica dust is deadly to inhale. Sotero Munoz is 58 years old. He says he tries to keep up with the young guys on the crew, but he just can't.
Well, it's that I have a bad back. The bones in my spine are wearing out, so I can't do heavy lifting. I have to rely on drugs, pain medication from Mexico in order to continue.
In Mexico, Munoz didn't do construction. He built furniture. But the company he works for hasn't provided him with a lot of hands-on training. Mostly his boss addressed safety in the interview.
He asked what I knew how to do, and I told him what I knew how to do, which is very different here and in Mexico. It's a different system. In any case, he told us to do things right, to be careful, and when we see something bad or wrong, to tell our immediate supervisor, or to tell him.
Munoz's story isn't uncommon around Wyoming. As the energy industry has boomed, so has the Latino population. According to the U.S. Census, the number of Latinos has grown in Wyoming by 60% since 2000. There are now over 56,000 Hispanics in Wyoming. With Wyoming's low unemployment rate, they're snagging high-paying construction and energy jobs that others aren't applying for. Rick Rubelt is Director of Environmental Health and Safety for Hazelden Construction. The company just awarded the job of building Laramie's new high school. He says they're looking to the Hispanic population to find workers.
I think we're going to continue to see Hispanic workers grow in the construction industry. One is the Anglo worker is reducing in the construction industry as far as quantities of people available. We have to adapt. We have to be able to understand and work with other folks. And we're obligated under the OSHA standards to make sure our crewmates and team members understand in their language.
Nationally, Hispanic fatal injuries exceeded all U.S. workers by 35%. And studies show that Hispanics are more likely than other workers to encounter barriers to occupational safety, such as a limited knowledge of English and worker safety laws. With employment in Wyoming dominated by high-risk industries, a state expert says the number of Hispanics that are hurt or killed could rise rapidly.
What you don't hear much discussion about are the non-fatal injuries. You know, there's been a lot of attention on oil and gas, but if you look at the total number of hospitalizations, construction leads the pack.
That's state epidemiologist Max Sewell. So far this year, he says, two Latinos have already died in Wyoming's oil and gas industry. But he says the fatalities don't tell you everything.
If you look at the employment in Wyoming, there's a dominance in Wyoming of some high-risk industries, agriculture, mining, oil and gas, construction. I think many of those are industries that will attract Hispanic workers.
Trench cave-ins, electrical accidents, slips and falls, exposure to dangerous substances like silica dust, all are leading causes of construction injuries. Hazleton Construction's Rick Rubelt says he expects to need more bilingual trainers in the next few years to keep his Latino workers safe in such a risky industry. Along those lines, Wyoming Workforce Services is updating their website to include training videos in Spanish. They also keep several translators on staff to help Latinos fill out forms and answer questions. But what Wyoming is not doing is collecting data about Latino injuries and deaths. State epidemiologist Sewell says the only way to get that would be sorting by hand through workers' compensation claims for Hispanic surnames. But University of Wyoming law professor Michael Duff says this wouldn't provide reliable data.
Wyoming specifically excludes undocumented workers from coverage under the statute, one of only two states to do that.
So what that means is that undocumented Hispanic injuries aren't counted. The other problem is that Wyoming employers have to foot the bill for those injured workers.
A couple of years ago, there was an undocumented worker that brought a tort case, a personal injury case, in the federal district court in Cheyenne and won, I think, a couple million-dollar verdict, which you wouldn't be able to get under workers' compensation because of the limited remedies.
And it's a more endemic problem for Wyoming in general because, as Duff says,
somebody's going to pay. So if you have a worker who is not covered under workers' compensation, okay, what happens? Well, their families are not going to have money coming in, and they're going to be destitute, and they're going to become wards in one way or another of the state. And this was the original sort of economic justification for having a workers' compensation system.
Duff says there's good reasons why every other state in the nation offers workers' compensation to undocumented workers.
Because the more people you exclude from the risk pool, the less you're able to spread risk. And the higher the remaining insured population, the higher the premiums are, right? So you want to include as many people in the system as you possibly can.
And since Wyoming doesn't track Latino workplace injuries, it's hard to tell if this influx of workers is on the front lines of Wyoming's dangerous industries. But experts say it appears they are. And since the undocumented aren't covered by workers' compensation, an injury could become extremely costly for Wyoming employers. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
When we come back, we will hear from the Secretary of State candidate Pete Illoway, State Superintendent candidate Bill Winnie, and a story on the education of music teachers. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Now we turn our attention to the Republican Secretary of State race. Last week, we heard from Clark Stith, and this week, it's Pete Illoway. Mr. Illoway has a background in working for both the U.S. and State Department of Agriculture, Wycon Chemical Company, and Coastal Chem, and the economic development operation Cheyenne Leads. He's currently a consultant and a lobbyist. Illoway was a state representative from 1998 to 2012. During that time, he chaired a committee that worked closely with the Secretary of State's office. He joins me now.
Let me ask you about elections. Obviously, sometimes I have a conflict of interest on this issue because I want the elections system to go as well as possible so we can report on it. But as you look at how things are handled in the state, one of the things I know you've talked about and even some of the other candidates have mentioned is modernizing things and using technology. Do you see improvements that can be done in that area?
Absolutely, Bob. In that office, it can be improved. That's not to say that Joe Meyer didn't do a good job or Max. They've done great work, and the people in that office. But I would like to see us have election night returns faster than they are. That would be a goal right away to get that done. And then there has been a suggestion about e-poll books. And in other words, in Laramie County, if you're in Pine Bluffs and you want to vote down in Pine Bluffs, but you really, your precinct is in Cheyenne, you can do that because of the computers. So I think there's some things in the elections division that we can really take a look at and work towards modernizing that that area.
Getting the returns in quicker, obviously that's a cooperation thing with some of the county clerks. How would you maybe get past that?
Well, it's not only coordination with the county clerks, but it's broadband. Mm-hmm. It's trying to get onto the internet in some of those areas, and we need to figure out how it works. The governor's initiative with broadband throughout the state, that's an area that we'll work with. It is technology. Technology is there. Let's learn to use it and try to improve that system of election night returns. It's archaic, and we need to do it better.
The office has been very involved in looking at things such as fraud and you know, protecting consumers and that type of thing. Is that something you do you like where that sits right now, or would you like to beef that up at all?
I think the registered agents area, Max brought that to us, that office got rid of a lot of registered agents that had no physical basis in Wyoming. They still are working on that. As far as fraud in the compliance area, which is securities, that area registers 84,000 stockbrokers, constantly is looking at securities that are sold in Wyoming. They just finished taking a case to the U.S. attorney. It took them 18 months to take care of it. They're very adept at taking a look and making sure that scams and fraud in that compliance area don't occur. And that's important for seniors and for everybody in the state of Wyoming.
Pete Illoway is joining us today. He is one of the Republican candidates for Secretary of State. One of your opponents has brought up the idea of maybe making some cuts in staffing in that office. I was curious your thoughts on that.
There are 31 total people in that office. That includes the Secretary of State. That office spends about, their budget is $7 million a biennium. In a biennium, that office brings in $38 million worth of fees and so forth. I don't see how you can say that those 30 people that really are working there, that it's overstaffed or anything like that. No, I do not want to make any cuts. If there's any cuts, it's going to be way later down the stream after we really take a look. But right now, the business division is the area that has the most people, and there are no programs written to take care of the business filings. Now, there is one in Colorado. We might be able to bring that to Wyoming without reinventing the wheel. But right now, I don't see any way you can cut people and continue to do the job that office does. Absolutely not.
You talked about bringing more technology, and we talked about some of that with the elections discussion we just had. But what are a couple other things that you're interested in, maybe in that area or just overall hoping to change in the office?
Well, you know, the office also has the secretary sits on the three boards, the SLIB board and the State Building Commission and the Board of Land Commissioners. When I've traveled the state, I've found that there are people that have grants or loans in with the SLIB board, but it takes them 3 days to get here. They spend a lot of money to come down for a 15-minute presentation before the SLIB board. There is no reason that we can't use closed circuit broadband or internet or Skype or VoIP or whatever and allow those people to stay in their home county, present to the SLIB board, and not have to spend $1,000 or $2,000 to come down here and be away from their offices. So I think technology, we need to embrace technology in the secretary's office, but we also need to embrace technology in all the elected's office.
This issue always comes up, and I thought I'd ask all of you this question, but talking about the other boards and commissions, one of the things you get a chance to talk about from time to time is what to do with state lands. What's going to be your philosophy as far as disposing or keeping state lands?
Well, the state lands are there to provide funds for schools. There are some state lands that are nominated to be disposed of. As a matter of fact, I sit on the Wyoming Business Council, and Riverton wants to purchase some of the land at the Honor Farm in Riverton because Riverton is really landlocked. That land has been nominated. I'm not sure that that's good, but on the other hand, for Riverton, they need some land so that they can expand. I think we want to be very, very careful about getting rid of some lands. State lands. And state lands right now, it's optimized. The rentals are optimized. Rather than being the optimum, it's the best use for the land. And you may not get absolutely the best amount of money, but it's an optimized rental rather than trying to get every last penny out of it.
Pete Illaway, he's one of your Republican candidates for Secretary of State. A pleasure chatting with you as always. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
You can learn more about Pete Illaway and his website, PeteIllaway.com. UW's Masters of Music Education program welcomed its largest ever cohort of summer-only students this session. The degree program is a draw for music teachers from around the state who want to use what little spare time they have to grow in their careers. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank reports.
It's before 8 o'clock in the morning, and there's a surprising amount of noise coming from a basement classroom in UW's library. Inside is a group of about 25 sitting in a circle, playing instruments or humming along. For most of the year, these people are music educators teaching in schools all over Wyoming. But in the summer, they're students themselves in a UW summer master's program. Today, they're learning a melody by ear.
One thing that we've been talking about is the difference between presentational music and participational music. So music that you just perform and music that you just get together and play.
Michael Cox is a band and choir teacher in Grable. He's playing along on his clarinet.
And that's one thing that I want to take away and show to my students is that you can just get together and play music.
Cox values learning alongside peers who spent time in K-12 education, teaching band, choir, or music.
I just finished my second year of teaching, and there are teachers in this cohort that have been teaching for 30 years. So getting together with a group of teachers who do the same thing that you do and have been doing it longer and trying it with different students in different ways, I think that's the biggest thing that I can take away from this.
Throughout education, it's difficult to get training in new concepts, but now is a good time for music educators to do so. The arts have just been added as an option in the Hathaway curriculum, and a new set of core standards for the arts has been developed. Ron Ryan, an orchestra teacher in Laramie, says they've spent time this summer getting up to speed on the new benchmarks.
Oh man, what a wealth of resources that was. So everything from guiding questions all the way down to worksheets and things that are available to help you plan your lessons is unbelievable.
The program is meant to appeal to mid-career music teachers, says Dave Brinkman, the UW professor who created it nearly two decades ago. Brinkman retired in June as the program's largest cohort ever works towards degrees.
The strength is that it allows people to get their degree, but over time, you know, and not have to concentrate it in 2 years and quit their job. So those are people that wouldn't probably have gotten their master's any other way.
Students have some online coursework in the spring, but most happens over three summers. This is summer number two for the current group. There's a lot of focus on creativity and improvisation. Students learn folk dancing and make didgeridoos. Tanya Severson is a K-6 music teacher in Cheyenne. She says what she learns here will come in handy in the fall.
Most of these classes, they really structure so that they are applicable right in our classroom versus, you know, undergrad, there's a lot more playing, there's ensembles. It's a great experience, but this is directed more at for teaching than anything.
In today's world music class, Professor Rod Garnett passes out a bunch of Peruvian panpipes, sets of bamboo tubes of varying lengths and tones.
The style that we play at the University of Wyoming is called sicuris, and we have a set of pipes, and they're divided. Each person has half the pipes that you would need to play a melody. So no one can play a melody by themselves. You have to have the other person there.
Garnett demonstrates with the help of his wife. Minutes later, the group has the tune down. Ellen Mayo is a K-6 music teacher in Gillette. She says exploring music outside Western tradition is crucial, but it's not something all teachers in the state are comfortable doing.
Being in Wyoming, we don't have a lot of different cultural experiences that students can go see. A lot of teachers sometimes don't bring in New World's music to the classroom because they don't want to do it wrong. They don't want to be, you know, inauthentic. Finding those resources and finding ways to bring those different types of music to students is very important.
Professor Garnett's work takes him around the world, and he gets students comfortable with many musical styles and instruments, from the Peruvian panpipes to the Balinese gamelan. Mayo says, in addition to knowledge and experience, students in this program gain a much-needed support system.
When we go back into the classroom and we're struggling or having a tough time, we have those resources to pull. We can call these other people so we don't feel so isolated. You know, I'm the only music teacher most of the days in my building, and for some districts, they're the only music teacher in their town.
Despite the challenges, Mayo says she's excited to get back to work in the fall and bring some new ideas into the classroom. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Aaron Schrank.
These reports are part of the American Graduate. Let's make it happen. It's a public media initiative to address the dropout crisis supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Three Republicans are seeking the nomination for state superintendent of public instruction. One of them is Bill Winnie. He is a retired naval officer who wants to bring that leadership experience to help run the State Department of Education. In the Navy, he trained a number of people and says training and education were part of his career. As we discuss some issues facing the office, we start with Common Core.
Well, Common Core is one of those things that started out as probably a good idea, started in the National Governors Association, and it was designed to address the mobility of our young people in and around the states. I mean, my oldest son went to three high schools in 4 years. Two of those high schools were half a world apart, one on the island of Guam in the Pacific and the other in Washington, D.C. area. And so that was the basic idea. And then how do you get students ready for college, make them college ready and everything? And as always happens, the devil can be in the details. And unfortunately, sometimes when bureaucracies, the federal level Department of Education, get a hold of things, they tack on things and bring in other things that people in Wyoming have decided they don't like. And the attitude you run into, sometimes, and this does not play well, is you don't understand how good this is for you. You need to just accept it. And so we're running into that kind of stuff, and the strings that go with it have me uncomfortable, and the strings that would take away some of the authority of our local school boards has me uncomfortable. Finally, as I've been out and about knocking on doors, and I've knocked on a lot of doors in the state, if a teacher comes to the door, you get a slightly different perspective. A teacher at the door will tell you, it tells me how to run my classroom, and it does not give me the flexibility to address the differing maturation rates of the students in my class. What do you do? How do you find the good things in it and get rid of the things that the people of Wyoming don't want? That's something I will take on.
Well, you brought up next-gen science standards, and boy, I haven't seen many budget amendments that were more controversial than that one. And
I saw that one when they put it in. Yeah. So, I was there.
So let me ask you about that. Was that a good thing for the legislature to have done, or should they have dropped the thing, and would you like to see those implemented?
I have formed the opinion that our legislature is acting more like a super school board. And that's not good for an organization. They're getting down into a level of detail that I think is not productive for the state. They should be dealing in overarching things. You've seen, perhaps you saw me take them to task over their evaluation system. They're specifying a level of detail. Well, this budget amendment, this little footnote they put on that one thing, is the same kind of level of detail. The other thing is they need to simply reaffirm that in our state, the local school boards have the authority to determine curriculum and leave it there. Because if a local school board picks elements of Common Core or Next Generation Science Standards and draws it into their curriculum, that's their business. That's what they're supposed to be doing, and I have no objection to them doing that. Now, what don't I like about Next Generation Science Standards? They haven't really racked and stacked all of the inputs in their analysis. Everybody says, well, they're scientists and so on, but, you know, people want to be able to look at what they say and draw their own conclusions, and one of the problems that I see is they don't enable people to do that.
Bill Winnie, he's a Republican candidate for state superintendent, visiting with us. And speaking of the legislature, one bill that they had talked a lot about and nothing happened this session, it died over in the House, was some legislation to potentially enhance how we do early childhood education in the state. I'm curious, is that something the state should be getting involved in, or is this maybe something that should be left up to the private sector, daycares, that type of thing?
And I spoke up on a bill probably a couple sessions ago that had to do with screening very young people for reading problems. One of our three sons had a reading problem that we didn't diagnose till third grade. If you back up to early childhood, age 4, age 5, age 6, and go in, and if you're able to diagnose those kind of things very, very early, they are much less expensive to fix than if you wait till the problem becomes full-blown, and now you have to go back and correct a full-blown problem. And that's the nature I spoke of on this particular bill. The name I don't recall, but I think it was two sessions, maybe three sessions ago. And so when you talk early childhood, I think the state has a clear interest in going out and doing some things early on so that problems don't become full-blown problems like this reading thing I talked about.
You can find out more about Mr. Winnie on his website, billwinnie.org.
When we come back, we'll wrap up the program with the latest edition of Wyoming Stories. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. It's now time for Wyoming Stories. Pat and Phyllis McKee grew up in ranching families in Elk Mountain. As kids, they avoided each other, but that did not stop the romance when they got older. Here, they reflect on their eventual romance and the details that led up to it.
It was New Year's Eve, and a couple of my hired man and a friend that I have here, they asked me to be the designated driver on New Year's Eve, and so I finally give in and said yes. And about 11 o'clock, she showed up, and she said, "Aren't you my cousin?" But we danced before, and I said, "No, I'm not your cousin." And I was more interested in dating her, and finally we got around to me asking her to date. And about 2 weeks, I called her, told her to call her in a couple weeks, and I did, and she was like, 2 weeks, really?
You're going to wait 2 weeks to call me? All right, I'll be patient.
And so we had a date a couple weeks into January, and I think in, what, February?
No, it was the end of January.
In the end of January, we decided to get married.
So 3 weeks after we met, we decided that we wanted to spend the rest of our lives together. So
she asked me first. So
we got engaged. Well, he asked me what I would, if I could have anything, what would I like to have? And I said, to spend the rest of my life with you.
So May, that year, May 26th, we got married.
Yeah, so parents were a little shocked, even though we'd been family friends. Pat and I had not associated with each other that much, you know, at all.
But I can remember you little. Your mom and my mom would meet in a store, and I'd boogie.
Usually Kmart in Laramie.
Phyllis would be there, and I didn't want nothing to do with you.
Well, and I would remember you with your pants tucked in your boots and your bright red hair taking off. But I guess it was one of those love at first sight kind of things. And my mom wouldn't speak to me for a while, actually. And I had to tell her what's going to happen, so I hope you're okay with it. And she came around, and in her eyes, it wasn't long, weeks later, and Pat was, the sun rose and set in him, and I just came along for the ride, so.
Yeah, but, my dad had so much respect for your family and that. He got me in the shop and some of the things I was doing. He said, Bud Orton would not stand for this. And he said, I don't know what you're doing, and a few times he chewed me out for what we were going to do, naming one of the kids. If we had a boy, we were going to name one of them Angus. And her dad was a still Hereford man. And my dad said, "You will not name one of the kids Angus. That would just offend Bud Orton." And so, but we're going on 25 years. We're working at it. We've had our ups and downs, and it's just been a fun ride. I wouldn't trade it for nothing.
Absolutely not. And my dad wasn't alive through any of this, so that's why he refers to he would have been upset, But I just think it's ironic and a little odd that I would always wonder what Pat was doing, but I never knew quite how to approach my dad with that because I didn't want to give him the inclination that I really cared what Pat McKee was doing, but I did want to know.
But, that's why it's an interesting story. And I don't know. I guess it was just meant to be.
I agree.
That's Phyllis and Pat McKee from Elk Mountain. They got married in 1990 and have three daughters. You can hear more Wyoming stories on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. That's our program for today. If you'd like to hear it again, listen to individual segments, or sign up for our podcast, go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Open Spaces. You can find links to past programs on that site, comment on the segments, and suggest ideas for future episodes. Anna Rader is our web editor. We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page and to follow all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.